Hi, I'm Tony Cox, and this is your Marketplace Money Podcast for the weekend of November 30th, 2012. Is it fear or foolishness preventing a deal on the fiscal cliff? No one can agree in Washington, it seems. Here's GOP Congressman Tom Cole and Speaker John Boehner on taxes.
Look, these tax rates are going up automatically unless Congress acts. I favor acting to save as many of them as possible.
I told Tom earlier in our conference meeting that I disagreed with it.
And the White House keeps pressing. Spokesman Jay Carney.
The president made clear that he is not wedded to every detail of his plan.
No wonder the rest of us are so ticked off. Here's how one woman put it.
How shall I say, a urinating contest between the Democrats and the Republicans with the budget. No one really wants to tax the rich because they're the ones that support the politicians.
Plus Powerball pandemonium and what winning really gets you. It's all ahead on Marketplace Money from APM.
Don't miss the numbers, the news, and Kai's final note. Subscribe to the Marketplace Podcast. Find it on iTunes or online at marketplace.org/podcasts.
Okay, hands up. Who's heard of the fiscal cliff? That's a lot of hands. I guess there is an upside to media frenzy after all. Now, here's the hard question. Who really understands what the fiscal cliff actually is? Okay, fewer hands. Not surprising. Most of the chatter we've heard about the fiscal cliff focuses on the deal or no deal deadlock strangling Capitol Hill. So what if, in the end, there is no deal? As the clock ticks, that's an increasingly likely scenario, and it's one, commentator Megan McArdle says, might just do us good.
Okay, for all of you not keeping score at home, here's what happens at the stroke of midnight December 31st if Congress doesn't act. The beloved payroll tax cut will expire. Extended unemployment benefits will be axed. Millions more households will be subject to the dreaded alternative minimum tax. And $100 billion worth of spending cuts to defense and domestic programs will go into effect. Oh, and everyone's federal income taxes will go up. By a lot. Economists say nearly $600 billion will be sucked out of the economy unless something is done. A growing number of people, let's call them cliff divers, say, bring it on. With unemployment still hovering right around 8% and economic growth anemic, this sounds kind of crazy. But then, so is a political culture that can't seem to come to even the smallest agreement over how America should reduce its trillion-dollar deficit. The sensible way to handle things is to extend the tax cuts and keep government spending where it is while the economy is still weak, then work on a set of long-term changes that would bring the budget into balance. Some tax hikes, some changes to entitlement programs, probably some defense cuts. But if our lawmakers are incapable of doing the sensible thing, and so far they have been, then a collective dive over the cliff may be the next best choice. That's because it won't necessarily be a free fall. Lawmakers will have a little while before the tax hikes really begin to bite. Long enough, hopefully, to see the damage they've done and come to their senses. If nothing else, it might allow Republican lawmakers who signed the No New Tax Pledge to agree to new revenue without technically violating their pledge. After all, once all the tax cuts expire, a vote to restore some of them isn't a tax bump, it's a tax cut. Granted, this is no one's idea of the best way to get budget reform. But if it's the only way to get budget reform, we may need to all hold hands and jump.
Megan McArdle is a special correspondent for The Daily Beast. Jumping off a cliff, fiscal or otherwise, it doesn't sound so appealing to me, and I don't know anyone who thinks it does. But maybe it's not so bad if you really understand what the fiscal cliff actually is. So we sent Mary Schell and Candace Manriquez onto the streets to find out who knows what.
The question is, what is the fiscal cliff? I have no idea.
It's something about Bush's tax cuts. They're going to expire soon, and if Obama doesn't manage that right, the economy is really going to tank again.
What is the fiscal cliff?
The fiscal cliff is the economic crisis, the money. We're about to go over our deficit. The money that we owe is about to surpass it, and there's definitely no way to overcome it. So once we go over that cliff, I believe that's it.
It's a, a urinating contest between the Democrats and the Republicans with the budget.
As far as I know, it has to do with the tax cuts that were given to people who make a lot of money by the previous administration, the Bush administration. They're going to expire I'm not entirely sure. And it also has something to do with the budget, like the balancing of the budget. And if it doesn't happen, then we're allegedly going over the cliff.
That was Joseph Estrada in Los Angeles, and in New York, Rory Grable, Adrian Andreev, and a lady who wished to remain unnamed. A few folks answered, I don't know. Not surprising, but all in all, not bad.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
Tax hikes are one part of the fiscal cliff. Another is so-called sequestration, or automatic spending cuts in government programs. If politicians cannot agree on a deal to cut the deficit, the Pentagon alone faces $500 billion in cuts. Defense spending typically brings to mind expensive weapons programs, you know, planes, tanks, and the like. But there's more to it, a lot more. Marketplace's David Gura takes a look at what those cuts could mean for active duty personnel and returning veterans.
Zach Zimmerman was only a few weeks into his freshman year at Ohio Wesleyan University when he felt pulled in a different direction. He wanted to serve his country.
I was really felt a calling to join, so I think really before anyone knew I had left school, I was in boot camp.
Zimmerman enlisted in the Marine Corps. In 2007, he went to Iraq. 2 years later, he was in Afghanistan. Today, he's at Georgetown. Zimmerman is a junior studying in the business school, and he's here thanks to the GI Bill.
I think it makes things so much easier.
Like roughly 1 million vets, Zimmerman gets $1,000 a year for books, a housing allowance, and...
If you go to a state school or a community college or any sort of public university, you get it's 100% free. You're not going to pay tuition.
Zimmerman goes to a private school, so he gets about $18,000 a year from the government, and Georgetown kicks in another $5,000. So should he worry about what would happen to the $23 billion GI Bill if the government goes over the fiscal cliff? Todd Harrison with the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments says not to worry.
The GI Bill is not part of the defense budget, actually.
The program is overseen by the Department of Veterans Affairs, and it's what's known as a mandatory part of the federal budget.
For people who aren't budget geeks, that's where things like Social Security and Medicare are funded. So Congress does not have to come back each year and continue to approve the program. It just automatically continues on autopilot unless Congress wants to step in and change it.
The GI Bill is safe, and so are salaries for active duty military. By law, automatic spending cuts can't affect combat operations, but many other educational programs are not safe. Larry Korb used to be an assistant secretary of defense under President Reagan. Now he's with the Center for American Progress.
There is a lot of, exclusive of the GI Bill, a lot of education and training that goes on for the force.
They're what are called peacetime operations, like that Marine Corps boot camp Zach Zimmerman went through.
You take young men and young women into the service, or you put them into boot camp, for example, or basic training in the Army. And then, of course, you have your military academies, which train officers.
There are the war colleges, there's the Naval Postgraduate School, the Air Force Institute of Technology. In its budget request for the coming fiscal year, the Pentagon has asked for $125 billion to pay for readiness and training. Analyst Todd Harrison says that would not be protected.
High-priority programs, low-priority programs, they all get cut by the same percentage, 10%.
So the military could face a choice, train servicemen and women less, or train fewer of them. The White House maintains automatic cuts would not affect combat readiness, but the truth is, we don't know how the Pentagon would make these cuts. Harrison says the Defense Department will continue to act like it's business as usual until it isn't. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
In his reporting, David has made the point over and over that the real issue with the fiscal cliff is the uncertainty. No one really knows what will happen to the economy if we go over the edge, and for that matter, no one really knows what our politicians are doing about it either. David's reported extensively on the noise coming from Capitol Hill, so I wanted to ask him whether he could tell us what all that noise really amounts to. Hey, David.
Hey, Tony.
Listen, it's hard for me, and I'm sure for others, to imagine that Congress would actually let the nation go over the fiscal cliff a la Thelma and Louise, and yet here we are, 4 weeks away, no parachute. Is there even a sense that Washington can deal with this and get a deal done?
I would say that people here are optimistic, and I think that's because lawmakers are keeping pretty busy.
They're meeting with CEOs. They're meeting with small business owners. They're meeting with other lawmakers and with people from the White House. So they're talking about this stuff a lot, and that engenders some confidence, some optimism that they might be able to do something. In the last week or so, I'd say we've seen politicians indicate they're at least open to making a deal, or more open to making a deal than they said they were on the campaign trail. So I think there's hope, Tony, but time is ticking.
You know, that's interesting, because I was going to ask you that very thing about what we've heard from Republicans in the House as well as from the White House about their willingness to listen. But, you know, we've heard this before, and yet, you know, here we are again. How much stock can we put into that?
Yeah, you know, as I said, time is ticking. Congress only has a few more days scheduled to be in session here in Washington. And I think that's a big motivator. I think that they want to get some sort of deal together before the holidays. So that's pushing them to do something. And I think that's, you know, more acute than it was when they were on the campaign trail, when they had a host of other considerations, namely political considerations, pushing them in different directions.
You know, the thing that doesn't make any sense is this. We look at Congress behaving this way, failing to find compromise so far. You know, people are getting angry. You know, why is it so hard, David, to fix this? Why can't the people that we send to Washington to do what we send them there to do, just do it?
I could give you some excuses. I'm sure they could give you some excuses, too. I mean, there's politics. There's pride. I think there are people who are worried about their jobs themselves. We could even give them the benefit of the doubt and say, you know, maybe just some of them believe with real fervor that they're on the right side of these issues. But I think you're right. I think Americans have every right to be upset with how glacially slow Congress has acted over these last couple of years, really. Their job is to come here to govern, and governing requires working across the aisle, working together. And, you know, if they can't do that, they can't govern.
So what would you say, David Gura, is the latest date that we can expect to hear from, you know, our representatives on this issue?
So the last day that the House is scheduled to be in session is Friday, December 14th. And I looked up the Senate schedule. They have to be determined for their target adjournment date. So they could burn the midnight oil. They could stay in Washington a little while longer. They could stay till Christmas or through Christmas. We hit this fiscal cliff, of course, at the end of December, and the new Congress arrives in Washington in early January. So in theory, they could work up until then. I think the hope is that they can find some sort of agreement before the holiday break.
One last thing. This is how Washington works, isn't it?
It is, and yeah. It can be frustrating. And it's interesting just to see and to talk to people outside of Washington to get their sense of what's happening here. Yes, it's the way Washington works, but it's the way Washington's been working lately. I think it's been interesting, to say the least, to watch how Congress has operated over these last couple of years, where there's a lot of short-term extensions. There's a lot of, you know, let's do something, maybe something small, and push the big decisions down the road. I think maybe this is a point at which Congress has to do something, has to come to some agreement on a bigger deal, something they've put off for a long while.
I think interesting would be a definite understatement in this case. David Gura is with Marketplace's D.C. Bureau. David, thank you very much.
Thank you, Tony.
And now it's time for your letters. I'm joined by Liz Weston. She's personal finance columnist for MSN and author of the book, There Are No Dumb Questions About Money. Liz, nice to see you.
Good to be here, Tony.
We are talking about the fiscal cliff this week, of course, and we know that the media coverage has freaked a lot of people out.
Yes, it has.
I imagine that your readers are asking a lot of questions, aren't they?
Well, interestingly, they weren't really tuned in until,
really?
Yeah, just lately. I think it's finally occurred to them that their paychecks are about to get smaller. So what is this fiscal cliff? How is it going to affect me? Why does Congress put us through this so often? Those are the kind of questions I'm getting.
Questions without answers, it seems.
Exactly.
Absolutely. A lot of folks might think to themselves, Liz, that I want to lock in any gains that I've made from my investments this year. And I'm worried, though, that the cliff is going to do something that will harm me. So what advice would you have for anyone who is considering selling all of their stock?
I am not a person who believes in trying to time the market, particularly when Congress is involved. Now, because they haven't come to a decision or a compromise, the stock market is going to be volatile. That's just life. If you were planning to take a gain in the next month or so, yeah, maybe you want to do it before December 31st because capital gains rates are low. They're scheduled to go up. I don't think they're going to go down. So if you lock them in now rather than a month from now, you might save some taxes. Otherwise, I wouldn't worry too much about it. If you have a situation where you have very wealthy parents, there is something that's going to change, and that's the estate tax exemption amount. That's going to change and go down, gift tax exemptions. That's something to take to a tax pro, though. This is not something to do a do-it-yourselfer on. And in general, if you have questions about your tax situation, a tax professional is a great person to ask.
It just seems like this year, more so than others, December is a time to really concentrate on your taxes.
Yeah, absolutely. Every year there's, you know, general advice that you want to, you know, maybe push income off and speed up deductions. This year it's exactly opposite. If we are going to see tax rates go up, you know, you might want to take the income now, put off the deductions. But the fact is, nobody knows. So if you do go to your tax pro, he's going to lay out or she's going to lay out a few options or scenarios. But really, until Congress acts, we aren't going to know what the future looks like.
Listen to me. I'm taking up all the time. We're supposed to be listening to the listeners, and I'm trying to get my own questions answered. Let's go on the line right now and talk to John from, I think it's pronounced Anoka, Minnesota. Is that right, John?
Yes, it is.
So I know it's in Minnesota, but where in Minnesota is that?
We're about 40 miles north and a little bit west of Minneapolis.
Okay, you in the snow right now?
Just barely.
Just barely. Okay, well, welcome to the show. What question do you have for Liz?
Well, you know, the question really revolves around what it's going to take to build a credit rating. Now, this is really for my daughter. She graduated last May from college, and between her working and, I guess, my working, we got her through college with no debt.
Wow, congratulations.
Man, that is great.
That's a big deal.
Good for you.
And she actually had a very good job during college, and so she was able to come out of college with about $8,000 in the bank.
Wow.
And she's got a car that's, you know, a reasonable car, about 100,000 miles on it, that still runs very good. It's all paid for. So she landed a job in Minneapolis, one that she wanted this last summer. So she decided she wanted to try to buy a foreclosed house. She doesn't want to rent.
Okay.
So in the meantime, she's living with me. And so when she went to try to get pre-qualified, she could not get pre-qualified whatsoever because she had no credit rating.
Oh, yes.
So to kind of get around that, what we ended up doing, she did find a house that she really wanted. You know, it was about a $70,000 foreclosed house. And so the way we're going to do it is that I'm going to buy it. The bad part is that now I have to buy it as an investor.
Oh, yeah.
Which means, you know, a high down payment. But that's not a big deal on a house like this. So anyway, that I'm going to buy it. She'll live in it, make the payments, and then once she builds up a credit rating, she'll just buy the house back from me.
Okay, so what you're looking at is how to speed up that process of getting her a credit rating so
right,
she can take this house off your hands, or this mortgage off your hands.
You know, what she did was she picked up a Visa card from the credit union.
Okay, that's great.
This last summer, and so she's been using that gas and meals and things like that, and then paying it off every month. And so she's kind of, you know, kind of at a loss as to just really what else she can get that she doesn't have to really end up paying a lot for to
yeah.
help build that credit rating.
Well, this is actually a fairly common problem of people who avoid debt wind up having no credit score or no credit score to speak of. Credit scores are really important in today's life, and it doesn't mean that you have to go into debt to have a good one. The way she's using that credit card is absolutely the right way to go. Charge a little bit on it, make no more than 30% or so of the credit limit. Pay it off in full every month. You do not need to carry debt to have good credit scores. If you want to speed things along and you're comfortable with this, you might consider adding her as an authorized user to one of your credit cards if
okay.
you have one. And you want to talk to the credit card company first to make sure that your information for that card will be exported to her credit file, because that doesn't always happen, particularly if it's not a spouse. But sometimes it does, and that's a way to get a kid kind of a jump start on a you know decent credit score. She might want to look at getting another credit card at this point. Having a couple in the mix can really help. Another thing that can help is a small installment loan, maybe if she wanted to, you know, replace that car at a certain point. So see what happens. You might want to track her FICO score or have her track her FICO score, because that's the one that most lenders look at. You go to MyFICO to buy that. And just keep track of it and see how her use of the credit card is helping. The only question I have is sometimes credit unions don't report to all three credit bureaus.
Okay.
So if they don't, she might need to look into what's called a secured credit card. That's where you give a sum of money to a bank,
right.
Capital One, Orchard Bank, whatever, and they give you back a credit card with a line of credit in the same amount as your deposit. So that's another way to get going.
I got a quick question for you, John.
Yeah.
Who taught her how to handle her money like that?
Probably her mom.
Hey, John, thank you very much. Good luck with that.
Sure, thank you.
Amy from Bakersfield, California. Amy, how are you?
I am doing great. It's nice to have you on the show. You're on with Tony and with Liz. So what's on your mind today?
Well, I have a question about student loans. My husband and I have student loans totaling about $107,000. Most are at 6.8%, but one is at 7.9%. And we really feel like these student loans are holding us back. So our plan right now is to just live on a smaller budget and pay as much as possible towards those student loans. And ideally, we'd like to try and pay them off in 2 years.
Wow.
I guess my question is, are there any downsides to doing this? Should we be saving for retirement instead?
That's a great question, Amy, and I'm glad you're asking it. First of all, I totally support the idea of continuing to live like broke college students as long as possible. That is absolutely great.
Yes.
But the thing is, with this federal student loan debt, I know 6.8% and 7.9% seem high, but that actually historically is relatively low for an unsecured loan. And the fact is, the interest is tax deductible, and it's very flexible debt. If either of you were to lose your jobs, if you had any other financial setbacks, you could get deferrals or forbearance. You have all kinds of ways to pay it back, graduated payments, income-based repayments. There's even the possibility of forgiveness. Doesn't sound like you're going to need that. If you can pay it off in 2 years, you probably won't. But I would say you are at a great time in your life to get started with saving for retirement. You do not want to pass up those opportunities to put money in a 401k, get a match, put money in an IRA or a Roth IRA. Get started now, and you will have so many more opportunities when you're older. You know, you can take some time off to have kids. You can take a sabbatical, whatever. But if you put it off, the longer you put it off, the harder it is to catch up. So I would say don't be in such a rush to pay off those loans. Take a look at what your retirement savings opportunities are. Make sure you have adequate insurance. That's really important. Health insurance, maybe life or disability insurance. Make sure you have an emergency fund. Then start pounding away at that student loan debt. Make sure all your ducks are in a row before you go after this relatively low rate tax deductible debt.
That's really good advice. Can I share something with you, Amy?
Sure.
In my office at my home, I have on the wall my paid off college loan.
Awesome.
So one day you will be able, when you get that paper and it says stamped, paid in full, put it in a frame and put it on the wall. It's a great feeling.
That's a wonderful achievement. Congratulations.
Congratulations. Thanks for calling.
Thank you.
And Liz, we have another California caller on the line right now. Mike is from Sacramento. He has a question about his mortgage. Hi, Mike.
Hello.
What's your question?
Well, I'm going to be paying off my mortgage in a few years, and I really enjoy having that mortgage interest deduction. And I'm wondering, is there a scenario where after I've paid off my home, should I take out an equity loan or something of that nature in order to get a mortgage interest deduction? I don't really have a need for the cash, but I'd like to keep my tax liabilities as low as possible.
You know, Mike, I understand that. What we can't let the tax tail wag the dog. And let me make it real simple. I've got a deal for you where you give me a dollar and I give you back 25 cents. Would you take that deal?
No.
Okay. That's what you're essentially doing with a mortgage tax deduction. You're paying a dollar in interest only to get maybe 25 cents back from the federal tax authorities, from the IRS, maybe a little bit more from the California Franchise Tax Board. But really, you don't get 100% back. So it really doesn't make sense to keep a mortgage just for tax purposes. Now, we were talking with Amy about her student loans, and mortgage debt is kind of similar to federal student loan debt in that it's relatively low rate, it's tax deductible. So if you already have a mortgage, you don't necessarily want to be in a huge rush to pay it off because there are more important things to do with your money. You should be saving a lot for retirement. You should have a FAT emergency fund. You should make sure you have adequate insurance. Maybe if you have kids, you should be saving for their college. Once all those ducks are in a row, then great idea to pay off your mortgage, but not before then. And if you are in the wonderful situation of having a California-sized mortgage and being able to pay it off, I would just applaud yourself for that. I wouldn't be in any hurry to extend it or do anything else because, as I said, the tax deduction is really not the reason to have a mortgage.
The situation that Mike is talking about is one that I think a lot of people fantasize about, which is being debt-free.
Yes.
But are we ever really?
Oh, yeah, you absolutely can get there.
Really?
I just think some people prioritize it over all other financial goals, and that's not a good idea, really. Retirement is going to be incredibly expensive. I think, much more than people expect. And I don't want to discourage anyone, but the later that you start saving for retirement and the less that you save, the harder it's going to be to have a comfortable retirement. This is why retirement has to come first. Before all your debt payment plans, before everything else, you got to be putting that money away for retirement. Then you can fill out around the edges and do the other stuff that's important, you know, insurance, emergency fund, paying down debt. But you really don't want to be that, you know, go hard to pay off all the debt and then worry about everybody else or everything else, because you're going to be too far behind the eight ball. It's really hard to catch up. The longer that you wait, the harder it is.
Hey, Mike, how long have you been in your house?
11 years.
That's fast.
Yeah. Did you have a 15-year mortgage, or have you been paying off a 30-year one faster?
I have 30, paying it off faster.
Wow. Man. Okay. And you don't sound like you're that old, Mike.
I just mid-30s.
Wow. Man, that's remarkable.
This is a guy that's got, he's on the right track, isn't he, Liz?
Well, let's ask, are you saving for retirement as well?
Yeah, maxed out every year.
Oh, dude.
Man.
Are you married?
I was going to ask that question. Are you married?
Yes, I am.
Oh, lucky girl.
Man, this guy has really got it going on.
Congratulations, dude. That's great.
Absolutely. Great, Mike. Thank you for calling.
Thank you.
We have another caller. Let's see if this caller is like Mike and has done all the things that Mike has done. This is Sarah from Arlington, Virginia. Hi, Sarah.
Hi. How are you doing?
We're doing fine. What do you do there in Arlington?
Oh, I'm actually, I'm the chief operating officer at a local nonprofit.
Awesome.
Yeah. Okay.
And that's... so because of that, a lot of my family and friends turn to me for financial advice.
But... I was going to say you get dragged in the corner right. at parties a lot. Yeah, I know that one.
So although I do work in finance and accounting, personal finance is not my necessary area of expertise. So I listen to the show pretty religiously, and I pick up tips to give them. So.
All right.
Well, that's what we're here for. Great. Well, that's what Liz is here for sure. So what is your question?
So my issue is that my father, who is retired, was recently contacted by his employer to receive a lump sum payment of his employer-funded retirement benefits. Not the 401k, but something where he gets, you know, a payment every month. The lump sum payment would be about $100,000 less than, you know, the present value of all these future payments that he would have gotten.
Right.
But the sum, if he would take it, would be inheritable.
Ah.
Yeah.
So it wouldn't end at his death. It's something he could leave to you.
Well, yes. And his grandkids. He was thinking more of the grandkids, but.
Okay, cool. We'll take the self-interest out of it. That's
exactly.
cool.
Exactly.
Okay.
So he spoke to a fee-only financial planner who recommended that if he did take the lump sum, he should invest it in an annuity with survivor benefits.
Oh, okay.
Because he kind of relied on this employer-funded retirement. He doesn't have a huge 401k socked away.
Okay.
And so, but I've only heard kind of bad things about annuities. My question is, what do you think about these lump sum payments from employers? And have you had any good experiences with annuities in general?
Before you answer her,
yes,
let's explain to those who may not know what annuities are.
Yes,
I know
absolutely.
You were going to do that.
Yes. And here's the thing. Because there are so many different type of annuities, because they're so complex, people hear all kinds of things about them. Here's the big issue is that there are two very different kinds of annuities. One is sort of a retirement savings vehicle. You're putting money away and hoping it will be there for you in retirement. That's the one that tends to get the worst rep because it's often sold to people to whom it's unsuitable. It's not the best way for them to save for retirement. There's another type of annuity. It's called basically a fixed immediate annuity or a fixed annuity. You give a lump sum to an insurance company. They promise to pay you back a series of payments over time with possibly a survivor benefits like we're talking about here. The disadvantage of the fixed annuity, the one that's paying you all the time, is that right now interest rates are so low, the payouts aren't that great. So these fixed annuities can be a good part of your retirement. They can be like a pension, you know, something you can count on every single month. But a lot of financial planners I talk to are kind of reluctant to recommend them right now just because of that low rate. Anytime you're looking at an annuity, you want to have an objective second opinion, somebody that can look it over and tell you if you're making a good deal or not. If you talk to an insurance salesman, you're going to walk away thinking it's the best thing ever because they're not necessarily going to emphasize some of the downsides, which happen to be things like surrender charges, you know, or the fact that, you know, you might be locking in a, you know, a certain return, but giving up the upside. So
it sounds like Sarah's got some homework to do.
Yeah, you know what? I would go back with your dad to that fee-only planner and ask again, you know, what you're talking about, and maybe even bring the insurance salesman in with you so that you can get a better understanding of what this is, because it could be a really good part of his financial future, or it could be an expensive mistake. Mm-hmm. So you want to make sure you both understand what's going on here.
A really good call, Sarah. Thank you. And good luck with this.
Thank you.
Liz, of course, thank you so much for all the great advice today. Personal finance columnist Liz Weston manages the website AskLizWeston.com. You know it's a pleasure having you, right?
And it's a pleasure being here, Tony. Thank you.
The end of the year is coming up fast, and that means it's time to get your financial house in order. Taxes should be right up close to the top of your list, and as we all know, taxes mean questions. Fortunately, we've arranged for expert Luis Barajas to come in and talk to us in a couple of weeks. He'll be answering any and all inquiries related to the T-word. So, if you've got questions or concerns, let us know on Facebook, on Twitter, or on our website, marketplace.org. Most conversations about the fiscal cliff revolve around what people can do about it. Congressional representatives who can compromise, investors who can sell out before the end of the year, or taxpayers who can tweak their personal finances. But what about people who don't have anything to sell or much in the way of personal finances to even adjust? I'm talking about poor people, and particularly poor families with kids, families like David Garcia's.
I don't make ends meet. As every penny is tight. I just don't make it.
If we go over the fiscal cliff and some government programs are cut, things will only get worse for poor people like the Garcia family. Chrissy Clark is a senior reporter with Marketplace's Wealth and Poverty Desk, and she's here to talk with me about poverty, and particularly child poverty, in light of the fiscal cliff. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Let me ask this. Is today's poverty the same as it was in our grandparents' time? I mean, I know poor is poor, but is it the same?
Well, officially, the federal government started defining poverty in the 1960s, and the poverty line was the minimum amount of money a family needed to cover basics like food and shelter and clothing. But of course, over the years, our standard of living has changed, mm-hmm. It's risen. So now there are things that aren't even included in that calculation, things like childcare, transportation to get to and from work, not to mention things like cell phones and computers that once seemed like luxuries, but more and more, these are things that are pretty much required for a lot of jobs and day-to-day life.
One of the things that separates poverty today, it would seem to me, from poverty before is you can have two working parents and still be in poverty.
Right. And that's where things like childcare and things like that really come into play, because it becomes this puzzle of how do I afford to have my kids taken care of while I'm out making enough money to actually have our family be above the poverty line.
Has poverty been on the rise among all races and ethnicities, or has one group been particularly vulnerable to increasing poverty here in this country?
Well, if you look at the statistics, they're pretty shocking. So African American and Latino children have the highest rates of child poverty, and that's been true for a while. For African Americans, it's been around 37% compared to about 22%, which is the national average. The poverty rate for Latino children is just over 34%. These numbers are from 2011 census data, the latest numbers we have. You compare that with white children, where the rate was 12.5%.
Do we know why this is?
There are so many factors. Part of the problem is once you're poor, it's hard not to be poor for generation after generation. So if you are a child born to parents in the bottom fifth of the income scale, you're more likely to stay at the bottom in the U.S. than you would be in countries like Canada, Britain, Germany, and France.
So why has child poverty been on the rise in the last 10, 11 years?
I think that one of the easiest ways to understand what's going on is to look at the forces driving child poverty and look at the forces pushing against it. And really, at any given moment, the child poverty rate is kind of a reflection of how those two things balance out. So in the early 2000s, child poverty hit a historic low, and that low was thanks largely to a strong economy. But since that 2001 low, child poverty rates have been on a pretty steady incline, mostly due to a handful of underlying forces. One big thing, and this is a big one, is that across the country, people are facing stagnant wages while the cost of living rises. So many of the good-paying manufacturing jobs that have moved overseas mean that a lot of the jobs that are left for people who don't have a college education are really low-wage jobs in the service sector. These are minimum-wage jobs that often offer only limited part-time hours. They keep you in poverty even if you're working as much as you can, especially if you have kids. Take this young father named Curtis Tucker. He's 22 years old. He works at a warehouse outside Chicago and lives with his fiance and three sons. After a hard search, he found a job that makes $10 an hour. He works less than full-time, though he'd like to work more.
You know, I'm just, you know, struggling. I try to save because, you know, you try to save some money. And I really, really can't save, but I do what I can, you know, do what I can.
So Tucker's rent is $850 a month at a $10 an hour job that he's not even working full-time at because he doesn't have the hours. That means he can't really make ends meet.
This is not enough to support my family off of, really. It really isn't. So I'm really, you know, I'm budgeting, super budgeting skills. You got to have the best budgeting skills in the world. And I think I've acquired them.
Is he typical?
He's very typical. And more people in poverty are working. They're not people who don't have jobs and yet still are in poverty. And what's kind of scary right now is that a lot of the programs that people like Curtis Tucker rely on, their future is in a lot of question as we head towards the end fiscal, of this year,
the fiscal cliff. Those programs are going away if nothing changes.
Exactly. He can't afford health care for his children, so he relies on a state program. The money that funds that is mostly federal money, which might go away in some of these negotiations. A lot of the programs that poor families rely on are really at stake right now.
Chrissy Clark is a senior reporter on Marketplace's Wealth and Poverty Desk. Chrissy mentioned that wages continue to stagnate in this country, and that makes life especially difficult for mothers, many of whom have to find a way to make money to help support the family, of course, and still spend time raising their kids. Women in that situation are always looking for childcare that fits their schedule. Lindsay Patterson reports on a new business in Austin, Texas, that's trying to meet that special need.
Lauren Walls is a stay-at-home mom dipping her toes into the freelance world. 2 years after quitting her job as a corporate lawyer, she's decided to make a go at a writing career, starting with a food blog called Veggie Gourmet Mama.
Well, so I just pulled up my website and I'm looking at my stats for the last few days. I have a few posts that I wanted to work on today.
She's on her laptop in the kitchen while her 20-month-old daughter, Nora, takes her afternoon nap upstairs. A couple of paragraphs in.
And she's up. Yeah, all right, I'm going to go get her.
After 20 minutes or so of calming her cranky toddler, Walls carries Nora downstairs and sits down on the couch with her laptop. Nora quietly pushes her mother's hands away from the keyboard.
Honey, oh, you closing my laptop for me? Thank you, that's very helpful. Yeah, I don't think I'm going to get anything done with this child around.
Mommy.
Wall said it became clear early on in her new career that working from home was not an option. She started looking into childcare and came away with sticker shock.
Childcare is expensive. And it kind of blew my mind how expensive it was.
In Austin, full-time childcare for an infant will run you up to $1,300 a month, and a little less for older kids. Part-time isn't too much of a savings. And Walls felt uncomfortable with the cheaper drop-in daycare. Then she found a new business called Plug and Play, where she could pay as little as $200 a month. In return, she gets supervision for Nora and a quiet spot to work along with other parents. It's called a co-working space.
Traditional childcare is really set up to be rigid and around routine, so it is not necessarily conducive to people who have alternative work schedules.
Amy Braden is the owner of Plug and Play, which opened in July.
And basically, it's co-working with hourly childcare.
Places like Plug and Play have been popping up in recent years. In London and Atlanta, for example. This one is at the end of a strip mall in Austin's suburban northern fringe. When you walk in, you're greeted by a distinctively modern workspace. There are high ceilings and letterpress prints. You drop off your kids on the play side, which is separated by a heavy insulated door to muffle distracting noises. Then you get to work on the plug side.
We have semi-private work nooks. We have a work bar.
Pricing for plug and play works kind of like a smartphone plan. But instead of buying minutes and data, you first buy co-working hours.
We offer a work a little and a work a lot package. And our work a little package is $35 a month. And then we have the $100 work a lot package.
Once you're signed on for co-working, you choose a child care package. It works out to about $9.50 for infants and $8 an hour for kids up to 5 years old. That's comparable to prices for a drop-in daycare in Austin.
The pricing structure is still sort of a work in progress.
Braden is actively experimenting with the business model. The first few months Plug and Play was open, there were lulls when childcare was empty. Now she's trying out a part-time preschool where parents commit to 2 mornings or afternoons a week for seasonal sessions. Signing up lowers the price to $5.50 an hour. But if your kid misses class, there are no makeups. While drop-in is still available, Braden is banking on the preschool to create a more reliable revenue stream.
It's definitely a delicate balance because our business model takes two concepts and melds them together.
There's hopes of franchising once the business model is proven, but the concept has already met with success from moms like Walls.
It gave me a reason to sort of get out of the house, try it out, see how it went, baby steps, and as long as things keep going as they're going, then I see this becoming a really great new career opportunity.
It might cost her an extra few $100s a month, but for Walls, the ability to choose to work whenever she wants is worth every cent. In Austin, I'm Lindsay Patterson for Marketplace.
Okay, by now, you've probably torn up that big Powerball ticket. You were not one of the two lucky Americans with the winning $500 million scrap of paper. Oh, well, maybe next time. We've all heard, though, that lots of people who do win the lottery handle their winnings badly. But you know what? That's not true of everyone. Sandra Hayes won $6 million, that's after taxes, back in 2006. She split a $224 million jackpot with a bunch of coworkers. And because she made some smart financial decisions, today she's still in the money. Hi, Sandra.
Hello.
Nice to have you with us. Also with us, Susan Bradley. She is a financial coach and the founder of the Sudden Money Institute in Florida. Susan, welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
So, Sandra, let's start with you. After the initial shock, it had to be that, I'm sure, and excitement of winning wore off, what sort of tough personal financial decisions did you have to make about what to do with all that money?
Well, I had to make a decision as to where I was going to invest my money, how much, and I had to, come up with the budget that I can live on a monthly basis.
Can you describe, Sandra, briefly your financial situation just before the lottery win? I mean, were you working? Were you in, debt? What?
Okay, I was employed. I was a social worker. I worked for the Department of Social Services, Child Support Enforcement. My income was like $25,000 a year. It wasn't very much, and I live paycheck to paycheck. Sometimes I'll have to rob Paul to pay Peter.
Yeah, I know
but
that.
But I survived.
But I'm assuming you don't have to do that anymore.
No, actually, what I do, I live off of a fixed income. And I budget my money carefully. All my extravagant spending, I did that when I first won, such as paying off my house, paying off my student loans because I had three of them.
Now, that's not extravagant. Extravagant is buying a boat or, you know, something like that. Did you do that?
I did. I bought a used boat, a bass boat. I bought a new car, a Lexus, and then I purchased a new home, my dream home.
All right, so you got that out of your system, and now you've sort of calmed down and you're living on a managed income.
That's correct.
All right, let's bring Susan in here. What is the biggest challenge for people who come into so much money so quickly?
It's interesting. There's an adjustment period. Reinvention is what we call it. We say that when money changes, life changes. So it's managing change, and that can be stressful. And it sounds like Sandra did a good job of absorbing the shock of new money and then figuring out how to place the money that she did win into a position to support a life that she wanted to live long term. That's not easy to do. In fact, most people go through a series of regrettable decisions.
Give me an example of the kind of, you know, bad decisions people face and sometimes make initially.
Well, sometimes they seem to be positive at the beginning. They want to share money with other people, and they start to give money away. It could be to their church. It could be family. And if you don't know the boundaries of the money, if you don't know what it's going to take to create the lifestyle that you would like to live, even though it may be modest, you need to do that first. Sometimes people give it away and then there's not enough left over. Sometimes giving it away, you know, really ruins relationships too. It doesn't always go in the direction that you want it to go in.
Oh, yes. I most definitely ran into that situation. But mainly it was strangers that I did not know. They fell out of the woodwork asking for huge, substantial amount of money. Now, I did give some money to family members, but it was not a huge amount. You know, there's that gift tax clause. And I think in Missouri at the time it was $10,000. So what I did give was less than that. And once I did what I wanted to do, I learned to say no to people without feeling guilty.
Susan, that's a hard thing for people to learn to do, isn't it?
It is. What happens with a lot of people, and Sandra, I bet it happened with you too, is that when you find out you win, your whole body, your mind functions differently. You have a cognitive disconnect in your brain.
Did that happen?
Yes, it did.
Absolutely it did, huh?
Yes.
Sandra made reference to the gift tax. So, Susan, how big a deal is that in terms of organizing quick cash in a way that can work to the benefit of the person who was lucky enough to win it?
It's a big deal. It's an estate planning topic to have. Sometimes lottery winners will share their ticket before they claim so they don't have to worry about the estate planning part and the income tax part for someone else. So there's a lot of planning that should go in at least a month before the ticket is claimed.
When people do win this kind of money, you talked about it changing them, but it doesn't prevent them from continuing to try to get that type of infusion of cash over and over again if they can, does it?
No, it doesn't, and there's nothing wrong with that. Once you learn how to manage large amounts of money, you know, why not? It's just you don't want to live your life hoping that that next jackpot comes in. Money changes us, and probably in a very good way if you're conscious and you're aware and you have good people around and you can anchor into your values. It can be wonderful. It sounds like Sandra did a beautiful job with it.
Did you buy a Powerball ticket for the one that we just had?
I bought 10 Powerball tickets, and I did not hit one number.
Didn't hit anything.
No.
Sandra Hayes blogs about her experience winning the lottery at sandrahayes.authorsexpress.com. Susan Bradley is author of Sudden Money, Managing a Financial Windfall, and founder of the Sudden Money Institute. Thank you both for being with us today.
Thank you.
That's Marketplace Money for this week. Let us know what you think at marketplace.org or on our Facebook page. Next time, we call home ownership the American dream, of course, but in this market, the only people sleeping with smiles on their faces are the landlords.
About half of Americans don't have the credit anymore to buy a home. And so as a result, when rents go up, and it would be cheaper for them to actually buy a place, they can't. And landlords at this point understand this, and so they're able to raise prices on folks who have no other choice but to continue renting.
Marketplace Money is produced by Patty Hirsch with Devin Maverick Robbins and Lindsay Foster Thomas. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is Deborah Clark. The Marketplace General Manager, J.J. Yore. I'm Tony Cox. Have a great weekend.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the Subscribe to Podcast link and never miss an episode again.
This is APM.